Today's Access Utah episode was first broadcast in 2014.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today, we begin a series of conversations with authors featured on our Utah Public Radio book list. Julia Corbett's new book, Seven Summers, A Naturalist, Homesteads in the Modern West, is a story of a naturalist-turned-professor who flees city life each summer with her pets and power tools to pursue her lifelong dream, building a cabin in the Wyoming woods. The task involves the gradual and sometimes painful acquisition of flexibility and humility. And for her, homesteading is not about wresting a living from the land, but respecting and immersing herself in it. The process changes her in unexpected ways, just as it did for women homesteaders more than a century ago. Julia Corbett is a professor in the Department of Communication at University of Utah, and she is author, among several other books, of one of the first texts in environmental communication, which is called Communicating Nature, How We Understand and Communicate Environmental Messages. Prior to receiving her master's and a PhD at the University of Minnesota, she was a reporter, park ranger, naturalist, natural resources information officer, and a press secretary. And Julia Corbett, welcome to Access Utah.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
We appreciate you taking the time to be with us. I think one of the common themes running through all the things that you've done is naturalist.
Yes.
And you mentioned in your book that it goes back, I think, to your growing up in the Iowa woods.
It does. It does. I attribute that a lot. I think even though I'm living in a big city now, that for many people, those early memories in nature have a profound effect and shape the kind of habitat and landscape that you're familiar in. And the freedom we had in those woods to wander and explore and just be back by dinner time was really, really lovely.
You mentioned a picture of yourself about 7 years old holding a bouquet of white flowers, proof that, and the expression on your face, you mentioned,
right.
proof that this, and your mother calls you her little nature lover.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
So this began very early.
Yes, at least my comfort in the woods very much did so, and it was my playground. It was in a small town in Iowa, and we didn't have sidewalks, and our playgrounds were the woods. That's where we hung out, built forts, played in the creek. It was lovely.
You talk about that sometimes we have dreams. We can't really communicate them fully to others. But when you found this parcel, 10-acre parcel, we'll get into this a little later as well, in Wyoming, that you mentioned to your realtor, this is my dream. This is
yep.
what I pictured.
Yep. And I don't remember this, but my father told me later that he remembers when I was a very young girl, I want to say 5 or 6, that I told him that someday I wanted to have a cabin in the woods, and that's where I would write. And I do think that by the time circumstances in my life brought me to finding this land and building this cabin, that had just been kind of a little seed, not fully germinated at the time. But I do really think that many of the dreams that we hold, perhaps in abeyance for much of our lives, are very important, shall we say, directional tools if we listen to them.
Now, you mentioned that you have friends who are desert rats. They're never more at home than when they're out in the desert. Others, and you were a park ranger at Olympic National Park, I think, right? Are ocean people. But that's not you, but you're at home in the mountains.
I am. I don't like the heat. I think that's part of what makes me not as comfortable in the desert. But there's just not enough chlorophyll, I guess, in the desert. And
yep.
I really like the coolness of mountains, the smell, the birds, the creatures. I don't know. It's just the whole picture. I just feel the most comfortable in the mountains.
And there's a whole strain, native versus non-native. You mentioned at a hearing in Idaho, I can't remember what job you had then, a state senator asked you how long have you lived in Idaho.
Right.
And you said 4 years, and that wasn't enough for him.
He right.
snorted, rolled his eyes. He's native, you're not.
Right. And it comes out in several chapters in the book. I'm a Westerner through and through. I've lived most of my adult life in the West. And it's more kind of the 100th meridian west, and it's not one particular place. But I think there is enough sameness in the west, especially for westerners, that they can feel a bit of that western pride, even in differing types of state. My grandparents and great-grandparents were all from eastern Washington. So I remember as a child piling in the station wagon, and we always went west for our vacations. So I feel very, very rooted here.
And so having a lot of us listening to the program will have lived in the west all of our lives. You've lived several places, grew up in Iowa. What is it about the west? What makes you feel at home in the west? How do you explain that to friends who are from other places?
I need to work on that. It is hard to explain. I don't know if you've ever tried to explain it. It's there's something about the light, the dryness in the air, and the open vistas and distances that gives it. It is also the sparseness of population, the abundance of public lands. There's also, I think, in the West, at least for me, for many people, there's a strong belief in kind of do-it-yourself-ness and independence, and that appeals to me as well. And what I've experienced here in Wyoming, which is lovely, when you live in a small rural place, community and neighbors have a very different meaning. And I assume that might be true in other parts of the country, but for me, I very much felt that in the West, that there's a different sense of being there for one another when you're not surrounded by humanity.
Mm-hmm. And Wyoming, of course, the most sparsely populated state.
Yep.
1.2 people per square mile, is it?
It's fewer people than cows, I know that.
Yes.
And probably antelope as well, but yeah, very sparsely populated.
And so, but that would promote sense of community. When you find another person, I guess it's more rare you latch onto it.
Right, right.
So tell us a little bit about this place. We'll get into how you got out there. You're 30 miles from your post office, 50 miles from the store.
And actually, I kid people, I don't even measure it in miles. I measure it in minutes. So it is 30 minutes from the post office, and they give you a post office box if they don't deliver to your place at the closest location. So Bondurant is the closest place from my post office, but there's no shopping there. So 45 minutes in the other direction is Pinedale.
Mm.
So I'm pretty much in the middle of not populated areas.
which is what you wanted, right?
Yes, yes.
And you don't tell people exactly where this is.
I don't. And there is a name of the little settlement here that was once a gigantic kind of ranch. And I was asked at a reading in Pinedale why I didn't do that. And it was very intentional, kind of like if you have a favorite fishing hole or a hiking trail, telling people is not a good thing. I also changed all the names of my Wyoming neighbors just because I figured they didn't ask to be in this book.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you know it's between Pinedale and Bondurant.
Oh, okay. But I suppose if someone wanted to take an extended field trip, they could maybe go out and try to find your place. But and I think, you know, especially people in the West can understand your desire to keep this a little bit secret.
Right, right.
I'm always interested talking to people who are especially affected by nature, as you are. And I think, you know, most of us are if we really think about it and admit it. There seems to be a spiritual component to this. And you even talk about on Sundays, you go out hiking up in the Wasatch Hills.
Mm-hmm.
That's your church.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm lucky enough up here summers in the cabin that it can be church every single day.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that, and there's even goodness gracious research now to back this up, that the whatever you want to call it, nature, the beyond human world, the natural world, has demonstrated powerful healing and very restorative effects. So even if you don't want to bring the spiritual / religious into it, it's, I think our connection with nature is hardwired enough in us that if we do have the chance to step away from just our own species and get perspective on it, I think many people understand what that kind of immersing yourself in nature is all about. I think for me, it provides incredible grounding, kind of perspective on my own life, to step out of everything human for a while and to kind of set the human tendencies aside and adjust to the pace of something different from your everyday life. I think in many ways that's why so many people that I've talked to can relate to my experience, whether they do it or not, because the idea of a cabin in the woods, you know, that kind of dream resonates with people. And I think culturally it's in a lot of our literature, if not our experience, of being able to do that. So I'm lucky that I get to do it all summer.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I wonder, do you think this is this need to connect to nature, do you think it's universal? I could think of some people who are maybe raised in a very urban space.
I do. I really do. Without getting into some of the theories, and there's theories now that support this and experiments and whatnot, but there's a very famous study, and this was quite a while ago, of having people in a hospital and whether they had a room with a view of a tree and a room with a view of a building or parking lot, those who could sit there and gaze at the tree healed faster. And those types of studies about the power, the restorativeness, healing quality of nature are very much supporting that.
You have a new book you're working on. I promise we'll talk about Seven Summers, but this is interesting right here. A New Day for the Moon, and apparently you're investigating the ways in which modern life we sort of control nature, we even shield ourselves from nature, and you're trying to get away from that.
Yeah, A Regular Day for the Moon, and then the subtitles Culture and Everyday Nature. And I find this a lot in my students, too, that when we think of nature, we think of the Wasatch Mountains or the Wind River Range. We don't think of it as existing in our everyday lives. And to me, it all starts there. I mean, if you think of the nature that's in your studio right now, air, water, wood, all sorts of natural materials, we're very much surrounded by it, but it's disguised. It's kind of distanced from us. And I think when we forget those everyday and continuous connections that we have and how we depend on the natural world, that disconnects us in a way from its presence in our lives everywhere, not just in the mountains, but all around us every day.
And so how do we mend that connection then?
I guess the first step is being aware of it, that when you turn on the light switch or get a glass of water from the tap, that's a very long journey, I guess, that those resources took to get to you, and it behooves us to consider how they were obtained and how we're using them. I read this thing a couple weeks ago that was fascinating, that these researchers did there was a pair of tennis shoes that was made from in China, some fancy athletic shoe, and the shoe had something like 121 different natural components that went into making it. I mean, to me, that's mind-boggling, the way that we're using nature every day, but it's kind of disguised.
And therefore, we don't think about it.
Right, right.
Yeah. We're talking with Julia Corbett. She is a professor in the Communication Department at the University of Utah. Her academic studies have to do with how we communicate about the environment. Her new book is a memoir, Seven Summers, A Naturalist Homesteads in the Modern West, a story of how she fulfilled her dream of finding this 10-acre parcel of land up in the mountain country of Wyoming, and how she built a cabin there. Some adventures there, and she talks in the book also about the early homesteaders, especially women homesteaders. We'll get into talking about how she compares and contrasts their experiences with hers as we go along talking about Seven Summers. We'll have more following a break.
Today's Access Utah episode was first broadcast in 2014.
We're talking with Julia Corbett on Access Utah today. This is the first in a series of conversations we're going to be having with authors featured on our Utah Public Radio book list. We asked for your recommendations and recommendations from booksellers and compiled an impressive book list. You can find that on our website, upr.org. Julia Corbett's book was recommended by Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks. She praised the writing and told us it was a very good story, which is absolutely true. It's a good read, as they say. Julia Corbett is a professor at the University of Utah, and summers, she takes advantage of the, of course, the nine-month contract for professors and goes up to the Wyoming mountains, where she bought 10 acres of land and over seven summers built a cabin there. And Seven Summers, of course, is the story of how she built the cabin, the adventures there, what she learned. And there's Julia Corbett. There's a strain of history here. You're very interested in women homesteaders, the original mm-hmm. period. Yeah. I was very interested in learning about that. What got you interested in them?
I think it was a neighbor here who had been doing some research on women in the West, and I was at the Pinedale Library one day, and just started looking for some books on it, and read one, had to read another. I was flabbergasted when I learned that 12% of all the homestead applications were filed by single women, because the law stated that you just had to be a head of a household, and so single women applied for that. And I was struck by how some of the same things that they were looking for and seeking, whether it was sufficiency or space, freedom, independence, and so on, were very similar. Now, of course, many of them had never been West and only knew the West of writing and photograph and so on. But by reading about their experiences, I just thought, you know, if they can figure out how to do this and how to get help building something, and finding their way in the West, then maybe there was room for a more modern woman to do it likewise.
Mm-hmm. So they're inspirations for you.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could read a passage about this. It's page 11.
Page 11.
And just starting with the first full paragraph there to the end of the page, starting, it was obvious to me what attracted single women. It All talks right. about some specific homestead, and you talk about some specific women throughout the book, your neighbors and right. and these homesteaders from the early period.
Right. Okay. So just that first full paragraph,
and then continuing to the end of the page.
Okay. Yeah. It was obvious to me what attracted single women to head west and homestead. In the 1860s, women wore corsets and long skirts, rode side saddle if at all, and had few choices beyond wife and mother. Fathers and sometimes brothers dictated whom a woman should marry. Homesteading offered single women freedom and economic security on land of their very own, a chance to choose something of their own making and to create their own experiences. That was indeed a new and heady notion. May Holliday wrote that she felt this in the air as soon as she crossed the Rockies. My former ideas of the importance of class distinction and the observance of social conventions seemed to fall from me like a heavy cloak, which had long been a burden, and I was free, free to live my own life in my own way. Alice Day Pratt, who homesteaded in Oregon in 1910, wrote that when she boarded the train to head west, she had no regret of what she was leaving behind, the competition and life at high pressure, and she anticipated instead calm, freedom, limitless spaces, hope, and opportunity. The cloak of social conventions is less heavy now, but a single woman building a cabin in the woods is still a highly unusual occurrence. Sure, Dad would visit each summer for a week, but I was embarking on this venture alone, without husband or partner. The land title was in my name. I weathered life in that meadow by myself, and my future there sat on my shoulders.
So when you were out building this cabin, you know, with help, but you were definitely spearheading it many, many stretches alone, did you have some of these women in mind?
Probably not individually, because what I read about them was kind of snippets here and there, and they didn't really fully, you know, actualize as individual people, but collectively very much so. Mm-hmm. And I also thank my lucky stars more than once that I didn't, that modern dwellings and construction and so on had regressed enough that I didn't have to hand peel my logs and chink them and deal with a constant flow of rodents in the house. Although I did in my motorhome, but yeah.
You did in your motorhome. So it's interesting that and I hadn't realized this, the Homestead Act purposely, and you write controversially at the time, was gender neutral.
Right.
In other words, it only mentioned a person. If a person takes so many acres and, you know, homesteads on it, then they can have it. I guess the exception is if you get married within a certain period of time, the title would revert to your new husband.
But, right.
So that did attract, and that was purposeful, right, because Congress wanted women in the West.
Yes. And they thought, and women realized, too, that getting your own piece of land and whether you just proved up on it and sold it or you stayed on it, that it really was a great way for many women to get some economic security that they wouldn't have otherwise. And the lawmakers were also wanting women west kind of as a civilizing influence, thinking that they would help with kind of the community structure in many of these small towns.
So when you embarked on your adventure, definitely an important part of this was power tools. And as I was reading this, I was thinking, well, that isn't, you know, if what you were going for was an authentic sort of an experience,
right.
You know, maybe that violates that. Of course, it makes it a lot easier.
Right.
Not to say easy, but a lot easier.
Yeah, but I think those women homesteaders would have embraced power tools as much as I did.
Yes. And there's something about power tools. You talk about the words like thrill and danger.
Yep.
If you're holding a chainsaw, there's danger there.
Yep. Those came slowly. It wasn't like I bought power tools immediately and came up. The whole, and hence Seven Summers, it was a slow process, and it was me even getting comfortable with the idea that, oh my gosh, I have land, what do I do next? I was very naive, but I kept thinking it was that strong dream that kept me going and helped me just kind of leap in whether I knew anything about it or not. And it was after watching and learning from the different men and a woman or two who helped me on my cabin and watching them with the tools and then also remembering my brothers and their work with tools that I very slowly got confidence, started with the chainsaw that my dad and I used, and then when it came to the finished work for the cabin, the power nailer, the chop saw, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and the nail gun. If you've never used a nail gun, that your description of that was very apt. And there's a lot of power there and danger there.
There is, yep.
Yep. That compressor kicks on and it can go through, you know, several pieces of wood. There's definite gender stereotyping here, isn't there?
Yeah. And I've been asked this question in readings before. For some people, the chauvinism does come out, and they kind of leap to assumptions that I couldn't possibly be doing this by myself. But then there are other people that I've met who very much have embraced it, and good for you. You know, how could I help? And that sense of community, I guess, again. Mm-hmm. So it's varied. It hasn't been 100% one way or the other.
And you talk about how you first learned to use some of these power tools, chainsaw, for example, mm-hmm. with your ex-husband, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, early on, you sort of accepted the, or maybe fell passively into some you know, gender roles. He mainly used the chainsaw, you stacked the wood, that kind of thing.
I think many people of my age are... Our parents had very gendered relationships. My mother raised us and kept the household together. And So I think many of the early baby boomers who were coming of age when women's issues in the 60s and 70s were taking off, that it wasn't automatic then. And I must say, for even women today, it's not automatic that, oh, let's figure out how these tasks should be divided, gender or not. It's just, it's a cultural pattern that I think, no matter the age, can be very easy to fall into. But I think what's important, at least to me, and for many of the young women that I teach and work with, is that you consider not just what culture expects of you, but what you want to do and what appeals to you, what sounds fun, what are your skills, what are you good at, and try and let those guide you as much as any cultural constraints.
I was interested to read that when you went off to college, your dad was very concerned that you'd learned two things, right? How to put oil in the car and in the lawnmower.
Yep.
And when you would report back, their questions would be about your classes and not so much about your love life. That sent a message to you.
Yep. I did get the messages from both parents that it was a good thing to be independent, and it was a good thing to know how to do things, to fix things, to definitely to figure things out. And the figuring out helped me immensely at various stages in the cabin when I would have a construction quandary and not know what to do. I describe one instance of when I was living in Dory, this ancient motorhome that I lived in before I built the cabin. The water pump went out, and you're up here in the middle of nowhere. What on earth do you do? And I kind of had my dad's voice in the back of my head, you know, just figure it out. Just sit there, evaluate it, figure out how it works. And it took me a few days of going back and forth and kind of staring at it, but I figured it out. Mm-hmm. So I think self-sufficiency, whether it's, and again, kind of back to my students, it's hard not to do when you're a professor. So many of them don't know how to cook. They don't know how to sew on a button. And, you know, those are all the things that were very, very important of my generation and my parents, of learning how to do things for yourself.
I wonder if I could have you read another page. This is, I believe it's page 134.
Okay.
Kind of straining with my eyes. It's a very small page number.
Okay.
It's in the chapter called The Dado. And it's a very interesting, moving passage. Your mother, you mentioned, was a stay-at-home mom. She had earlier designed clothing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But she was content to stay home and proud of it. And then you talk about how you found an article where she had expressed some feelings. You found this after she died.
Right.
So you're
starting with the years after.
Years after she died, going down to the bottom of the page.
Years after she died, I found a feature article on Mom and her weaving printed in the little local newspaper. She told the reporter, "With the world now, there are things that make you feel that being a person at home is just a really dumb and lazy thing to do. I find that distressing. A beautifully run home with an interesting person is wonderful, instead of two tired, desperate people trying to get ahead. I don't consider myself submissive, but making someone happy, making a nice place to live, it's a nice thing to do." Mom indeed worked to make her husband and children happy, which involved incredible self-sacrifice and serving others at the expense of herself. That wasn't something I could see myself doing, though it's exactly what I fell into with my ex. The statistics show that women don't benefit from marriage the way men do. Married men live longer, are richer, excel at their careers, and are happier than single men. But married women do not live longer than single ones, and they earn less, are significantly less healthy, and are more likely to suffer from depression. Yet marriage remains the normative destiny for a young woman in Utah. Self-sufficiency is sadly not a quality found in many of my female students. A great many can't cook. I once asked a large auditorium of students how many knew how to check the oil level in their cars. Only a few hands went up, all male. A professor friend was coordinating a field trip of her nature writing class to a city park, and one female confessed that she needed a ride because, though she had a car, knew how to drive, and knew where the park was, she was too afraid of getting lost.
And that, Yeah, that's distressing.
You
describe maybe a certain percentage of your female students would fit into that category.
Yes.
I was curious about your mother. That was an intriguing quote that I probably intriguing for you as well when you found that. And I wonder, did that have you reassessing your mother's contentment or not with her role or not?
No, it mostly made me sad how she was questioning her role. I remember her coming to me a time or two, probably in the early 70s, height of the women's movement, and asking me, should I get a job? I think she worried about contributing economically to the household. And it was just kind of the cultural context of that period that was having her question what she had grown up doing and was very happy with. Mm. It was more her questioning.
Hmm. And so what is your advice to, obviously you would like your female students to be more self-sufficient. Imagine that's what you tell them. And I'm guessing there are some conversations started when they learned that you build a cabin almost by yourself in the woods.
It's not even just the female students, though. It's the male ones, too. They don't know how to cook either. Or change the oil or sew on a button. And those are things that both my brothers and I learned growing up. And so I think those kind of life skills are very important for both men and women to learn. Mm. I suppose since the book just came out, I haven't had that many interactions with students about this, but one thing I am doing a couple places on campus and even privately is I've been teaching some young 20-somethings to cook because the learning curve is steep for them, and I totally understand that. And it's been very fun and rewarding, but I don't think you can live healthily or well without being able to cook.
Hmm. Yeah, I was just going to mention that, not only self-sufficiency, but health as well.
Yep.
I want to get into talking about some of the lessons that you learned. One thing that's inspirational about the book is this idea of pursuing your dream.
Mm-hmm.
And you write that you did have the dream, and when it sort of crystallized, you just made the decision, maybe not sitting down and doing pros and cons, but just going forward. And the reaction that you got from your father probably would have been typical of a lot of people.
Yeah.
That he said, really, this is what you're going to do?
Yep. And I think I mentioned that before. I think if someone has a strong dream, that is one of the more powerful inner intuitive things that deserves being listened to. And I think eventually my dad got that and understood, and because he's the one who remembered that I'd said it when I was a very young girl, that, okay, she doesn't know how this is going to work. She doesn't know where the money's coming from. But at a certain point, I think, to follow your dreams, you have to be willing to risk and kind of jump off the diving board and figure it out. It doesn't mean you're rash about it, but that you are willing to take risks and kind of head into the unknown and not be paralyzed by it. Mm. And I could have easily have been paralyzed. There are so many decisions, big and small, that are involved in something like this. But you can't let them paralyze you. You have to kind of keep moving.
And to be clear, to remind our listeners, you went into this never having done construction, right? You didn't know how to build a cabin.
Nope.
Hardly knew how to operate a chainsaw.
Right.
And the list goes on and on.
Right.
So I don't know. Would you advise others from what you've learned from this? If I wanted to go build a cabin, starting next summer, would you advise me to go forward?
If that was your dream. Mm. But I guess I would kind of equate this particular dream of mine to other dreams that people have. If someone says, I want to become a successful musician and they've never played a note in their lives, if that's a really strong dream, I think it deserves being tried. Or even if getting married or embarking on any new relationship like that is a big leap of faith. You don't know what's going to happen. But if it's a strong enough belief that you have, I think you deserve to let yourself leap.
We're talking with Julia Corbett. Her new book is Seven Summers, A Naturalist Homesteads in the Modern West. It's the story of Julia Corbett, naturalist turned professor who flees city life each summer with her pets and power tools to pursue her lifelong dream, building a cabin in the Wyoming woods. And this she did over seven summers with some help, but a lot on her own. Julia Corbett is a professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Utah. Her previous books includes one of the first texts on environmental communication, Communicating Nature, How We Understand and Communicate Environmental Messages. And before she earned her PhD and began life as a professor, she was a reporter, park ranger, naturalist, natural resources information officer, and press secretary. We're going to get into some of the lessons learned and other topics when we come back following a break.
Today's Access Utah episode was first broadcast in 2014.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today, we begin a series of conversations with authors featured on our Utah Public Radio book list. Julia Corbett's new book, Seven Summers, A Naturalist, Homesteads in the Modern West, is a story of a naturalist-turned-professor who flees city life each summer with her pets and power tools to pursue her lifelong dream, building a cabin in the Wyoming woods. The task involves a gradual and sometimes painful acquisition of flexibility and humility. And for her, homesteading is not about resting a living from the land, but respecting and immersing herself in it. The process changes her in unexpected ways, just as it did for women homesteaders more than a century ago. Julia Corbett is a professor in the Department of Communication at University of Utah, and she is author, among several other books, of one of the first texts in environmental communication, which is called Communicating Nature, How We Understand and Communicate Environmental Messages. Prior to receiving her master's and a PhD at the University of Minnesota, she was a reporter, park ranger, naturalist, natural resources information officer, and a press secretary. And Julia Corbett, welcome to Access Utah.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
We appreciate you taking the time to be with us. I think one of the common themes running through all the things that you've done is naturalist.
Yes.
And you mentioned in your book that it goes back, I think, to your growing up in the Iowa woods.
It does. It does. I attribute that a lot. I think even though I'm living in a big city now, that for many people, those early memories in nature have a profound effect and shape the kind of habitat and landscape that you're familiar in, and the freedom we had in those woods to wander and explore and just be back by dinner time was really, really lovely.
You mentioned a picture of yourself about 7 years old holding a bouquet of like white flowers, proof that, and the expression on your face, you mentioned,
right.
proof that this, and your mother calls you her little nature lover.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
So this began very early.
Yes, at least my comfort in the woods very much did so, and it was my playground. It was in a small town in Iowa, and we didn't have sidewalks, and our playgrounds were the woods. That's where we hung out, built forts, played in the creek. It was lovely.
You talk about that sometimes we have dreams. We can't really communicate them fully to others. But when you found this parcel, 10-acre parcel, we'll get into this a little later as well, in Wyoming, that you mentioned to your realtor, this is my dream. This is
yep.
what I pictured.
Yep. And I don't remember this, but my father told me later that he remembers when I was a very young girl, I want to say 5 or 6, that I told him that someday I wanted to have a cabin in the woods, and that's where I would write. And I do think that by the time circumstances in my life brought me to finding this land and building this cabin, that had just been kind of a little seed, not fully germinated at the time. But I do really think that many of the dreams that we hold, perhaps in abeyance for much of our lives, are very important, shall we say, directional tools if we listen to them.
Now, you mentioned that you have friends who are desert rats. They're never more at home than when they're out in the desert. Others, and you were a park ranger at Olympic National Park, I think, right? Are ocean people. But that's not you, but you You're at home in the mountains.
I am. I don't like the heat. I think that's part of what makes me not as comfortable in the desert. But there's just not enough chlorophyll, I guess, in the desert. And I really like the coolness of mountains, the smell, the birds, the creatures. I don't know. It's just the whole picture. I just feel the most comfortable in the mountains.
And there's a whole strain, native versus non-native. You mentioned at a hearing in Idaho when you, I can't remember what job you had then, a state senator asked you how long have you lived in Idaho.
Right.
And you said 4 years, and that that wasn't enough for him.
Right.
Snorted, rolled his eyes. He's native, you're not.
Right. And it comes out in several chapters in the book. I'm a Westerner through and through. I've lived most of my adult life in the West. And it's more kind of the 100th meridian West, and it's not one particular place. But I think there is enough sameness in the West, especially for Westerners, that they can feel a bit of that Western pride, even in differing types of state. My grandparents and great-grandparents were all from Eastern Washington. So I remember as a child piling in the station wagon, and we always went west for our vacations. So I feel very, very rooted here.
And so having a lot of us listening to the program will have lived in the West all of our lives. You've lived several places, grew up in Iowa. What is it about the West? What makes you feel at home in the West? How do you explain that to friends who are from other places?
I need to work on that. It is hard to explain. I don't know if you've ever tried to explain it. It's there's something about the light, the dryness in the air, and the open vistas and distances that gives it. It is also the sparseness of population, the abundance of public lands. There's also, I think, in the West, at least for me, for many people, there's a strong belief in kind of do-it-yourself-ness and independence, and that appeals to me as well. And what I've experienced here in Wyoming, which is lovely, when you live in a small rural place, community and neighbors have a very different meaning. And I assume that might be true in other parts of the country, but for me, I very much felt that in the West, that there's a different sense of being there for one another when you're not surrounded by humanity.
Mm-hmm. And Wyoming, of course, the most sparsely populated state.
Yep.
1.2 people per square mile, is it?
It's fewer people than cows, I know that.
Yes.
And probably antelope as well, but yeah, very sparsely populated.
And so, but that would promote sense of community. When you find another person, I guess it's more rare you latch onto it.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about this place. We'll get into how you got out there. You're 30 miles from your post office, 50 miles from the store.
And actually, I kid people, I don't even measure it in miles. I measure it in minutes. So it is 30 minutes from the post office, and they give you a post office box if they don't deliver to your place at the closest location. So Bondurant is the closest place for my post office, but there's no shopping there. So 45 minutes in the other direction is Pinedale. So I'm pretty much in the middle of not populated areas.
which is what you wanted, right?
Yes.
And you don't tell people exactly where this is?
I don't. And there is a name of the little settlement here that was once a gigantic kind of ranch. And I was asked at a reading in Pinedale why I didn't do that. And it was very intentional, kind of like if you have a favorite fishing hole or a hiking trail, telling people is not a good thing. I also changed all the names of my Wyoming neighbors just because I figured they didn't ask to be in this book.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you know it's between Pinedale and Bondurant.
Oh, okay. But I suppose if someone wanted to take an extended field trip, they could maybe go out and try to find your place. But Yeah, I think, you know, especially people in the West can understand your desire to keep this a little bit secret.
Right, right.
I'm always interested talking to people who are especially affected by nature, as you are. And I think, you know, most of us are if we really think about it and admit it. There seems to be a spiritual component to this. And you even talk about on Sundays, you go out hiking up in the Wasatch Hills.
Mm-hmm.
That's your church.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm lucky enough up here summers in the cabin that it can be church every single day.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that, and there's even goodness gracious research now to back this up, that the whatever you want to call it, nature, the beyond human world, the natural world, has demonstrated powerful healing and very restorative effects. So even if you don't want to bring the spiritual / religious into it, it's, I think our connection with nature is hardwired enough in us that if we do have the chance to step away from just our own species and get perspective on it, I think many people understand what that kind of immersing yourself in nature is all about. I think for me, it provides incredible grounding, kind of perspective on my own life, to step out of everything human for a while and to kind of set the human tendencies aside and adjust to the pace of something different from your everyday life. I think in many ways that's why so many people that I've talked to can relate to my experience, whether they do it or not, because the idea of a cabin in the woods, you know, that kind of dream resonates with people. And I think culturally it's in a lot of our literature, if not our experience, of being able to do that. So I'm lucky that I get to do it all summer.
Yeah, definitely. I wonder, do you think this need to connect to nature, do you think it's universal? I could think of some people who are maybe raised in a very urban space.
I do. I really do. Without getting into some of the theories, and there's theories now that support this and experiments and whatnot, but there's a very famous study, and this was quite a while ago, of having people in a hospital and whether they had a room with a view of a tree and a room with a view of a building or parking lot, those who could sit there and gaze at the tree healed faster. And those types of studies about the power, the restorativeness, healing quality of nature are very much supporting that.
You have a new book you're working on. I promise we'll talk about Seven Summers, but this is interesting right here. A New Day for the Moon, and apparently you're investigating the ways in which modern life we sort of control nature, we even shield ourselves from nature, and you're trying to get away from that.
Yeah, A Regular Day for the Moon, and then the subtitle's Culture and Everyday Nature. And I find this a lot in my students, too, that when we think of nature, we think of the Wasatch Mountains or the Wind River Range. We don't think of it as existing in our everyday lives. And to me, it all starts there. I mean, if you think of the nature that's in your studio right now, air, water, wood, all sorts of natural materials. We're very much surrounded by it, but it's disguised. It's kind of distance from us. And I think when we forget those everyday and continuous connections that we have and how we depend on the natural world, that disconnects us in a way from its presence in our lives everywhere, not just in the mountains, but all around us every day.
And so how do we mend that connection then?
I guess the first step is being aware of it, that when you turn on the light switch or get a glass of water from the tap, that's a very long journey, I guess, that those resources took to get to you. And it behooves us to consider how they were obtained and how we're using them. I read this thing a couple of weeks ago that was fascinating, that these researchers did, there was a pair of tennis shoes that was made from, in China, some, you know, fancy athletic shoe. And the shoe had something like 121 different natural components that went into making it. I mean, to me, that's mind-boggling, the way that we're using nature every day, but it's kind of disguised.
And therefore, we don't think about it.
Right, right.
Yeah. We're talking with Julia Corbett. She is a professor in the communication department at the University of Utah. Her academic studies have to do with how we communicate about the environment. Her new book is a memoir, Seven Summers, A Naturalist Homesteads in the Modern West, a story of how she fulfilled her dream of finding this 10-acre parcel of land up in the mountain country of Wyoming, and how she built a cabin there, some adventures there. And she talks in the book also about the early homesteaders, and especially women homesteaders. We'll get into talking about how she compares and contrasts their experiences with hers as we go along talking about Seven Summers. We'll have more following a break.